About the time the present is not fun, like, say, when the pandemic flares up and puts us back in lockdown, the future begins to look really good. We need that level of hope. The future is a mystery, of course, if we choose to think of it as a very far away thing. But after all, 5 minutes from now is still in the future. We get a framework for thinking about time and the future in a new book called Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. The book is the work of Andrew Maynard, a former physicist, now professor in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society at Arizona State University and director of ASU's Risk Innovation Lab. Andrew is the author of an earlier book, Films from the Future. Andrew Maynard, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
It is great to be here.
So, films from the future. Anytime we talk about innovations, I try not to talk about sci-fi, but do you find it somewhat helpful?
Actually, yes, but in a rather obscure way. So the thing with sci-fi is that it gets things wrong. And anybody that has a science background and that watches science fiction movies will know how infuriating it is when they just throw the science out of the window. But what we find, and this is what the book is about, is that if we think about sci-fi as illuminating our relationship with technology and science in the future, it shows us some really interesting insights into what can possibly go wrong when you put humans in the mix and how to maybe avoid the worst successes of that.
You remain optimistic that there is a future, but you acknowledge that we have some difficulties this moment. In fact, your introduction makes reference to the pandemic, so you had time to get that in.
I managed to slip that in the very last edits. Yeah, so this is an optimistic book, but it's very cautious optimism, and there's an underlying feel there, which is very much part of my work, that we can actually build a better future, but we've got to pull ourselves together if we're going to do it.
Do we have to be more intentional about the future? I was reminded recently in a discussion about robots that we do tend to develop technologies and then figure out later on how to make them safe to use.
We do, don't we? Yeah. And it's been the history of humankind for the last umpteen thousand years, I think. I would argue, yes, we absolutely have to be more intentional. It's one of the immutable laws of the universe that if we just let things roll, things are going to get worse. So we have to sort of bring our quite incredible intellect to bear to work out what we want the future to be like and how we're going to build that.
You begin with Christmas Eve 1968 and the famous Earthrise photo taken from an Apollo spacecraft. Why start there?
So this is partially a backstory to the book, where I was talking with a colleague and he came up with this what seemed like a really silly idea about writing a book about the future as an object. And the conversation sort of went along the lines of me saying this is absolutely insane, but I couldn't get it out of my head. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought this makes sense. And where better to start than thinking about the Earth as seen from space as an object that metaphorically depicts our future? And Bill Anders' picture, that photo of the Earth rising above the rim of the room, the moon, really captures that idea that we have a future in front of us, and we can actually think about that as a tangible thing. But if we're going to see that come into reality, we've got to begin to think about it in a very broad and different way. So that's where I began sort of framing things in terms of Futurize with that picture. And then the book ends with this idea, or sort of Earthrise rather, with that picture. And then the book ends with this idea of Futurize. Sort of what is that metaphorical image in our heads which is going to inspire us to build a better future?
So let's come to what we're doing now then, instead of what you suggest in the book. Are we just living too much in the present, or, as you said earlier, just sort of letting things roll?
In some ways we are, yeah. There's a little bit of hope there. And so, for instance, if you see what's happening with vaccines for coronavirus, we're beginning to get our act together. But more broadly than that, if you look at the huge chasm between what we can do with emerging technologies, how society is beginning to evolve in terms of how we understand what is good, what is bad, how we connect with each other, how we sort of resolve our differences, there is a massive chasm between what we're doing at the moment and where we need to be if we truly are to build a better future.
You give us a brief lesson in the Big Bang and time itself, and then you get to potholes.
Yes.
Can you explain that journey?
Sure. So, as you know, I'm a physicist. I'm never quite sure whether I'm a former physicist or really still
I noticed the former and wondered about that, yeah.
Yeah, and I go back and forth on that. And it's partially because my work touches on so many areas outside physics these days. But it was very important to me that if we're beginning to think intentionally about what the future means to us, we've got to start with physics, because that's what defines what this thing, this difference between the past and the future is. And for that, you've got to go back to the Big Bang. So the book starts off just beginning to flesh out this idea of the future being part and parcel of the laws of the universe that evolved after that. And one of those laws is the law of entropy, which is effectively that left to its own devices, the universe is going to run down. The amount of available energy that we can use to do things is going to decrease until eventually we hit heat death. But this idea of entropy is really hard to grasp, and it's really misused. I think one of the lines I used, it's one of those things that really infuriates physicists when people misuse the concept of entropy. But to get to what this is and why it's important, I want a really simple analogy, and I'm not sure it's a great analogy, but it ended up in the book, and that's of potholes. So if you think about sort of a road, you have a beautiful smooth road, but if you're somewhere where there's a lot of rain and a lot of snow and a lot of ice, if that road isn't maintained, it begins to fall apart and you get these great big potholes which just kill you, or at least kill the car that you're in. And the fact that those potholes appear is because everything has this natural tendency to get worse, to get harder to navigate, unless we're constantly paying attention to how we keep it going and keep it maintained. And to me, it's a really good metaphor with our relationship with the future. If we just let things go, they're going to get worse. We've got to think intentionally about how we avoid those potholes of the future appearing.
So we're just getting into entropy and potholes. It's probably a pretty good analogy. It's if you leave them alone, that's what's going to happen. You're going to get bigger and bigger potholes until the road is just a big wreck. Jeremy England, you quote in the book, argued that life plays a particular part in entropy. Can you explain that, Andrew?
Sure, yeah. So this is quite a controversial theory. And you have to sort of go back to realize that from a physicist's perspective, the universe inevitably is going to run down. And because of that, life as we know it just seems to be an utter anomaly, because we seem to be reversing that arrow of time. We seem to be not only getting more complex ourselves, but creating an increasingly complex society, which is not what the universe is supposed to do. And scientists for years and decades have tried to wrap their heads around this. So Jeremy England came up with a really interesting idea where he basically said that the universe wants to reach the end of its life. This is sort of a natural phenomenon where it wants to get there as quickly as possible. And to do that, you've got to use energy up as fast as possible. In some bizarre way, what we as humans do is actually enable the universe to get to where it's going faster by using up energy really fast. So we might be building complexity at a local level and over a small amount of time, but as we do that, we burn through energy like nobody's business. So we're effectively entropy accelerators. And it's a weird idea. As I said, it's very controversial, but it also explains in some ways why we have such a richness of life here at the moment, because it's a way that the universe can punch a hole through the usual progression of things to get to the end of the universe as we know it faster.
So being alive, in essence, swims against the tide, in a sense.
It does, or it doesn't if you buy into this theory. But it means we're a little bubble of almost reverse entropy. We're able to pull energy in from the sun, and evolution does this. Evolution pulls energy in from the sun and builds life, which is more complex. Us as humans can do that even more effectively, which is great for us, and it's great for our future over the next 100,000, 10,000 years or so. But ultimately, entropy will out.
So as we think about the ways in which we as humans deal with the future, as you get into chapters on instinct, these are fairly short chapters, so it's kind of book you can read in little bits and pieces if you choose. But you also mentioned that you wanted to make it hard to put down, which I found it to be. Yes.
Oh, good.
But it's clear that we're getting past the edge of what our instincts are good for. Like our lizard brain has some serious limitations in a world of artificial intelligence and mass personal communication.
Yeah, so this is both the marvel of what it is to be human and part of the curse of our legacy. So all of us have got both this incredible ability to literally break the shackles of our evolutionary heritage as we imagine that what the future could be like, and we use our science and the technology to build it. But at the same time, we've still got those inherited instincts. And so these are the instincts that the fight or flight instincts, where if we perceive a danger, we'll either fight it or we'll run away from it. We still have those embedded in our brains. And of course, when you're facing a really complex technology like artificial intelligence, evolution hasn't prepared us for this, but we still respond in the same way. So the challenge then is, how do we overcome these inbuilt instincts which have served us so well for tens to hundreds of thousands of years, but they don't serve us that well now?
Which then gets us to things like intellect and reason. So we have to rely upon those things more. I did find myself smiling as I read your thoughts on reason and our ability to predict a future based on the past. I was smiling because pundits so often predict the future and are wrong about it.
They are, yes. We have so many examples of that. And that's one of the challenges we face. And of course, you've got to look at the past. And I also talk about cause and effect, that the future is all about effects that come from causes in the past. So those links are there. But the trouble is, the more complex the world becomes, the more tangled those links become. And that's where it is very, very difficult indeed to predict what's going to come down the pike from what's happened before. We can do it, but if we fall into the trap of assuming that tomorrow is going to be the same as yesterday, we're going to get it wrong.
Andrew Maynard is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. Now, faith gets a chapter right behind reason. Now, how can those two in particular work in tandem to shape the future?
One of the things I was particularly interested in is what makes us uniquely human. Because, of course, as we think about building a different future, it's got to be a future for us, and it's got to reflect who we are. And whichever way you look at it, you can't escape the fact that faith or our beliefs are part and parcel of not only who we are, but how we understand our place in the world and the universe. So there was no way I could not talk about this. But of course, this is challenging because it feels as if it goes against the grain of thinking about intellect and intelligence. The reality is, though, sometimes we kid ourselves that all we need is more intelligence and more intellect in order to make things that are wrong at the moment right. That doesn't work. We've got to think about the essence of who we are as people. And that brings in not only our faith, but our feelings, our emotions, our imagination, our creativity, our art, everything that makes us who we are.
Well, the art in particular gets interesting. Tell us about the story of the white fabric that you saw in this display.
Yes, this is. So, as a rather naive physicist or ex-physicist, I've long been fascinated by the role of art in society. And years ago now, when I used to work in Washington, D.C., I remember one lunchtime going to the National Art Gallery and seeing this piece of modern art, which was literally just a square of white fabric, a little bit like the handkerchief in my pocket pinned to a wall. And at the time, I thought, this is crazy. I could do this. What makes this art? What makes it special? And yet, the reality is that I'm still thinking about this 10-plus years later. So something about that lodged in my brain and has sparked a really interesting serendipitous train of thinking about the nature of communication and art, so much so that it found its way into the book. And that, to me, is a really good example of how art prompts us to think beyond the limitations of what we're conventionally exposed to and encourages us to see the world around us and our relationship to it in different ways. Maybe not ways that the artist intended, but certainly it's like a little grain of sand that lodges in your brain and forces you to create something new and different.
A pattern disruptor, in a sense.
That's a really good way of looking at it, yes.
So now our ability to see a better future than now certainly helps us to get through life when things aren't going very well. And you remind us of the Shackleton expedition to the South Pole that never got to the South Pole, and the ship broke up, and they crossed the ice and took a small boat, but the crew survived. I mean, but you bring up stories. You think Shackleton's ability to tell a story helped save his crew?
Right, and it wasn't just Shackleton, but it was the other leadership on that. But that was part of it. That particular incident, and of course, being British, it's part of our heritage.
Sure.
It was a combination of incredible technical ability amongst the people that were navigating across those seas, but the ability to inspire them through stories. And one of the things that is very, very clear as we begin to look at how individuals and how society works, we not only sort of build our own ideas of the future through the stories we tell ourselves, but we inspire others through the ways we tell those stories to others. You take stories away, it's very difficult indeed to inspire people to do anything, never mind to do anything better.
Andrew Maynard, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor at the School for the Future of Innovation in Society at Arizona State University, director of the Risk Innovation Lab at ASU, and the author of the book Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. It brings us from the Big Bang all the way up to thinking about how we think about the future and that we should probably do so more intentionally to make for a better future. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So now we're about halfway through the book, up to part three, Building the Future. And the words of the British author Laurie Lee come up first. They stick with you. Tell us about what Laurie Lee wrote about.
They do. And I don't know how widely known Laurie Lee is in the States, but he was an author who lived in a small British village just after the turn of the century, going from the 1800s to the 1900s. In his autobiography, he writes this beautiful passage of how life in that village had been pretty much the same for 1,000 years until the advent of the automobile, and then everything changed almost in an instant. And to me, it really captures this idea of both we can think that things are constant, but they're not. But also the power of one small change in what we can do to completely disrupt our relationship with the future and where we believe we can go in that future. Plus the fact he's just a beautiful writer, which is also why I was looking for an excuse to put that passage in the book.
I think about what he raises as well, and that is that we did move at about 8 miles an hour for thousands and thousands of years, and then in less than 100 went from motorized ground transportation to aviation.
Right, right. And so it's an idea, if you go back to the 1970s, the writer Alvin Toffler and his wife came out with this idea of future shock, that we're now living in an era where things are moving so fast that it just shocks our system. I'm not sure I buy into that, but it's still very true that for 1,000 years, as Laurie Lee said, that the horse was king and it determined the cadence of our life. And then in the last 100 years, everything has changed, up to the point that we're now seeing private space and craft take people up into orbit. Such a far cry from those 8 miles an hour of the horse.
Okay, so you say you have some questions about Alvin Toffler's approach, but do you think that humankind generally is out ahead of its skis or something, that we're beyond our comfort zone?
I don't think we're beyond our comfort zone, but I think that we don't understand our comfort zone. The point at which I'm not sure I buy into Toffler's ideas are I see very little evidence of people being stressed out by the speed of innovation. We are an incredibly adaptable species. We just suck up change like nobody's business. So most people are pretty comfortable with where we are. The problem is I'm not sure we should be. I think that we should be a little bit more scared, a little bit more on the edge of our seats, worried and excited about where we're going, because it's only then that we begin to think about how we're going to do it responsibly.
Are the major concerns then our impacts upon the planet, our ability to maintain the environment that produced us?
So those are big concerns, but there are also concerns around society as a whole, and those are concerns that go all the way from issues such as social justice and equity. How do we make sure that everybody has access to the future that they deserve or that they aspire to? To how do we actually build cohesive societies? So yes, of course, if you look out over the next 50, 100, 500 years, the health of the planet is supremely important. But if you forget about the nearer term cohesion of local society and global society and people's lives, you're missing something which is supremely important, because ultimately it's about people, not just the planet.
All right, we'll come back to the planet and the people in just a couple of minutes. I'm jumping ahead of the track here just a bit, but you do take some steps here, like to talk about Moore's Law, which is it's about the computer processing power, isn't it? And how much of a law did it turn out to be?
Well, so yes, Moore's Law predicted roughly that computing power was going to double, I think it was every year, I can't remember the exact details. It actually turned out to be pretty accurate, but not because it was a good predictive law. It was because the industry said, we're going to follow this and we're going to do everything possible to make this happen. But it is an example of how we've accelerated our ability to do things in specific areas.
Well, all right, then that's an excellent point. And you do bring up John F. Kennedy in 1962 saying, yeah, we should go to the moon by the end of this decade. And we did.
Yep.
That when we have done things like have a scientist who says, you know, computing power will probably double, that people actually put their mind to a task like that and achieve it.
They do. And of course, this comes back to our imagination as well. It's only through imagining that we can actually achieve something like that that we have the impetus to do it.
All right. So the idea, for example, as we get further into a future where humans share the planet with artificial intelligence, the idea of a singularity, the robots getting smarter than us. Do you have some doubts about that? As you have doubts about transhumanism too?
I do, and I've got a lot of sympathy for people that believe in transhumanism or are aspiring to that. This idea that we can just completely break away from our biological origins. I think there is a lot of naivety there as well, though, in terms of what we can achieve. And so this is where our hubris gets the better of us, and we imagine a future which is going to be next to impossible to achieve. The same goes for superintelligence, this idea that you have almost like a Terminator or Skynet future where computers get so smart that they realize the thing they really can't stand is people, and they try and get rid of us. That there are so many things that would have to happen for that to take place that it's almost impossible to join the dots. On the other hand, I do think there are major challenges with where we're going with artificial intelligence that we're almost being blinded to because we're obsessed with these more science fiction-like scenarios.
When you look back, though, at the things that people said about the future in the past, you know, or even the things that were happening in their present, like, oh boy, if a train goes faster than 30 miles an hour, it'll completely scramble your internal organs. Obviously, we got over that.
Right.
I mean, so when you look at the things we say about the future now, do you see, maybe you just did with transhumanism and robotics, that we're making similar misguided projections?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there are huge dangers here. So pretty much the only thing you can say about future speculation is that it's going to be wrong because the future is going to outsmart us all. So to me, rather than sort of getting worried about these speculative ideas about what can go wrong, it's far better to build an agility. So yes, we can move forward to the future, but we're constantly aware of where we might be taking missteps so we can course correct very rapidly.
Let's take a phone call in here. Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Maynard, the author of Future Rising.
Thanks very much. Here's my question. Is it possible that there is no limitation on the speed or range of consciousness?
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends how you define consciousness as well as speed and direction. What I would say is if you look at the human mind, it tells us two things. One thing is it tells us how incredible or what incredible things biology or the natural world can achieve. And the chances are that humans aren't the pinnacle of what we can achieve with consciousness. To me, there are no limits on where that can expand and extend to. On the other hand, it also tells us just how insanely complex things are. So the more we learn about the human brain and the human mind, the more we realize how much we don't know. So whereas I would say that biology and the natural laws of the universe indicate that we could go far further than consciousness than we are at the moment, the pathway to getting there is utterly obscure at this point.
So you all right, and how about ways in which we can enhance consciousness? I mean, you're not big on transhumanism, but I mean,
yep.
Are we talking about potential ways to biologically render ourselves differently in the future?
We absolutely can do, especially as we begin to merge ourselves with machines.
So a couple of other things that we're just talked about, the robots not necessarily getting faster than us, from your point of view, the whole idea of a matrix-like future, which we're all in a simulation, you seem to find some flaws with that too, Andrew?
I do, at least how people like Elon Musk think about it. And the idea is that one day computers will get so powerful that we can all sort of live inside a virtual simulation, which is so real that we can't tell the difference between that and reality. And maybe that's already happened. The reason I'm skeptical of that is that, and some people have looked at this, the degree of complexity that is needed to create a computer system that can mimic reality to that level of detail is just so stupendous that it's very hard to imagine how all of the energy and the material in the universe would allow us to do that. Of course, that doesn't mean it's impossible. It's just that it would be incredibly difficult.
Which got me thinking, I mean, would we each have our own simulation or would we share simulations with other people, which finally got me down to a real sort of square one question for you, which is your thoughts on how the societal and the political intrude into the technological, because a shared future implies we like each other enough to share it.
It does, yes. And of course, you cannot separate out the science and the technology from people, and by people I mean all of the messiness around politics and ideas and beliefs and aspirations. And I think one of the big dangers we make is to assume that technology is neutral and science is neutral. They're not. They're part and parcel of this huge, complex mess of humanity that we live in.
All right, so let's talk about some ways in which we try to do good things for each other by relying upon artificial intelligence, and these go awry. Talk about Predictim and what it tried to do.
Yeah, so Predictim, so this was a company that's set out to create an app that would allow you to sort of filter out good from bad babysitters. And it seemed like a great idea. So anybody that's a parent will know that if you bring somebody sort of you don't know into your home to look after your kids, you desperately want them to be a safe bet. You don't want to bring, I was going to say, an axe murderer into the house. I don't think there are many babysitter axe murderers, but you get the idea. So they brought out this app that used a little bit of machine learning that would allow you to type in the name of somebody, and it would scrape their social media, and it would give them a score as to whether this was a safe babysitter or not. Sounds like a great idea. Until people began to realize that the algorithms were biased and the information that they were using was biased, so potentially really good babysitters were being excluded from the system. More than that, they ended up with a black mark against their name, and there was such a hue and outcry against this that the app was actually taken off the market. So that was a really clear intersection between interesting technology, good ideas, genuinely good ideas that went really badly wrong.
Which reminds us that what we create is only as good as the people who create it. I mean, artificial intelligence still begins with a human's conception of intelligence or conception of the world around that human, which includes some baked-in biases.
That's it. You can't take people out of the system. I mean, especially with artificial intelligence, even how we think of intelligence is very much biased by who we are and what our training and our upbringing is. So, for instance, what people developing AI systems think of as intelligence may be utterly different from somebody else.
So this moves us into the fourth part of the book, The Edge of Tomorrow, and using this great intellect we have and looking at population charts and all, I mean, how do you think the future is looking at this moment?
I think we're on a knife edge, be completely honest. I think if you look at everything that we can do as individuals and as a society, we have incredible potential. There is nothing to stop us solving some of the biggest problems in the world. What puts us on a knife edge is two things. One is a seeming lack of willingness at times to do that, but also the reality that we've built a world that's so complex that understanding which levers to pull and buttons to press to build that better future is not that straightforward. And again, it comes back to sort of our instinct kicking in. If we rely on our instincts, our gut feelings with how to do that, we'll get things wrong because the world that we live in is so different from the biology we evolved through.
Do we, you know, it seems like every time we start talking, and there we have a fair number of listeners who call in every time we talk about population growth as the major problem facing the planet. I mean, is this just not something we discuss easily?
We actually have, since the 1960s and even before that, there has been this sort of up and down of talking about population growth. And there are, first of all, none of the predictions, none of the direst predictions have really sort of come true here, in part because we've always managed to science our way out of these dire problems that we see us facing. The challenge with population growth is, first of all, population growth, although it's increasing globally, is actually decreasing in areas. So you look at Japan, for instance, and they're heading for crisis because they don't have enough new people, new young people coming along. But the other part of it is we don't actually know the full carrying capacity of the Earth. And as our technologies and our science increase, so does our ability to increase this carrying capacity. So it's less a question of whether there are too many people, and more a question of how we're actually going to build the systems that are going to support them, but not only support them, but enable a really just and vibrant future and sustainable future as well.
And I find myself at this part of the book ranging back to part two about the uniquely human things that we have, you know, things like art and creativity and intellect and all of that. And I did find myself wondering if things like faith and hope work against us. Does optimism that the future will be all right lessen the probability that it will be?
It certainly can do it. And this is where I think we've got to temper that optimism with a good dose of humility and responsibility. Absolutely, if we just kid ourselves that everything's going to be all right, you go back to entropy, everything will not be all right unless we work out what we're going to do to make it all right.
Let us take some phone calls here. Benjamin in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Maynard.
Hey, it's such an honor and a pleasure to be here. I absolutely love this conversation. I'm an artist potter in Medford, and I just couldn't help but to call in. I'm really curious about the way that we keep our focus on the things that really serve our, for lack of better words, our stoke, the thing that really sparks our passion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When I was a kid, you know, I couldn't wait to become an adult because I knew that those adults were the people that made the future, made the laws and the rules, and built the toys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to me how we've created a lot of laws that aren't as fun as they could be. Like, why don't we have bike paths everywhere instead of cars? Because bikes are so much more fun.
Right.
Or even, you know, or slides instead of stairs if we're going down. You know, so
yeah.
How is it that we got so distracted from just the things that might make life so fun?
You know, I think it's in part because we got boring. The way we educate people and teach people to think, it is really constrained. I think we need a little bit of sort of childishness, a little bit of wonder and serendipity there, and a lot of imagination, because with that creativity and imagination and that desire to play and try things that are different, that's where we open up possibilities.
Well, thank you for that, Benjamin. The phone line's really lit up for this last 5 minutes. Let's talk to Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello there. I'm a big fan of science fiction movies. I love the creativity and the special effects, but I was wanting to ask your guest if he thought there was any possibility of the movies The Day the Earth Caught Fire, which talks about environmental disasters, and here the West Coast 2 months ago almost caught on fire, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, about what would happen if the first extraterrestrial visited the Earth.
All right.
Yeah, so I've in terms of extraterrestrials sort of visiting the Earth or as discovering intelligent life, I write about this a little bit in my former book, my previous book, Films from the Future, especially in the context of Carl Sagan's Contact. And I must confess, I'm a little bit cynical here, and I reckon that, well, first of all, if we discovered intelligent life elsewhere, I think it would be a seven-day wonder. We'd say, yeah, that's exciting, and within 7 days, we'll be back to life as normal, because people are like that. We forget how to be wondered so fast. But then sort of the question is, well, what if a super intelligent species came to us and said, look, you're just making such a mess of things, we're going to have to take control over stuff. I actually don't think that'll happen, simply because practically, even if that super intelligent species is somewhere in the universe, it would be next to impossible for them to stumble across us and do that. But even if they did, why would they care? And to me, this is why I love science fiction movies, because they get us to think in these interesting and usually helpful ways. But to me, the message from this is, if we want to get ourselves out of the mess we're heading for, we have the tools to do that, but we've got to have the will to do it ourselves.
which is one of the major points of the book. The book is called Future Rising. Here's a call from Karen in Mount Shasta with author Andrew Maynard.
Yes, I had heard about AI that was actually learning itself, so it wouldn't be limited by the programming. They made it, and then it learned kind of like a person's brain develops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is what researchers really want to see, and we've got very early versions of this where you can create a set of algorithms, which are the core, the brains of this, and you can give them a rough set of instructions, and they will teach themselves how to either learn new things or solve specific problems. It is very, very rudimentary at the moment, and we're not quite sure whether the current techniques are going to get us to where some people would like us to go. But certainly, we're beginning to teach computers how to teach themselves.
It seems like a fairly simple binary, though, doesn't it? I mean, where the computer says, okay, I'll learn to this point, and then I'll ask you for further directions, or I'll stop.
It sounds simple. Mm-hmm. It's much, much harder to program that in and to code that in. And part of it comes down to this idea of, can a machine discover something new? It's very easy to teach a machine to know what we know and to do things in the way that we do them. But when it comes to effectively creativity and discovery, that is much, much harder because we're not quite sure how humans do it, never mind how to train a machine to do it.
Jim in Grants Pass sent an email and asks, where are we going toward our understanding of each other and developing compassion and the ability to sustain ourselves without destroying the planet through exploitation and neglect of habitat and the ability to develop meaningful lives around family and each other?
What a great question. And of course, this is where the book ends up. And it points out that the future is about us. It's about people and it's about relationships. And no matter how fantastic our science and technology are, we have got to learn how to be better individuals, better humans, better members of society, because that is integral to us building a better future together.
Can we get, do you think, do we have the skills on hand at the moment to get to a place where people and planet thrive, assuming those things are not mutually exclusive?
So I tell you, I have my bad days and my good days here. I have days that I just look at what's happening in the world, and I think there's no way we're going to make it.
Mm.
And then something happens, and it restores my confidence. So individually, we have an incredible capacity, not only to sort of build a better future, but to build better relationships with others, to understand our relationships with others, and to work for the good of others. Too often, we just throw that away and we get caught up in our own instincts. But we have the capacity to overcome those biological roots and do better. The question to me is, will we?
Did this year in particular challenge your notions of the durability of humankind and its ability to solve problems?
Yes and no. It actually deeply saddened me with coronavirus that instead of working together globally, we seemed to shrink in on ourselves. And there was almost a competition around who was going to be the first to deal with this virus rather than pooling our resources. And so that, to me, really brought out the worst instincts in people to hunker down and not work together. On the other hand, what you're seeing now with the two vaccines that are coming out and are looking very promising, those are an incredible testament not only to our ability to apply cutting-edge science, but our ability to work together across country boundaries. So yeah, there's both optimism there as well as pessimism.
But a lot to think about. The book really moves along for a book that goes to the Big Bang to the future. It's called Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. It's the work of Andrew Maynard at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.